This is Marketplace from APM. I'm Kai Rizdahl. Imagine the best bottle of wine you can think of. Now imagine how much you'd pay for it. If you're a serious enophile, you'd best be thinking four or maybe even five digits, especially for red wines from Bordeaux, the vineyards in the southwest of France, considered by many to be the best in the world.
And the auctioneer was going like $300,000, $500,000, $700,000. Then suddenly I just raised my paddle. I said $1.5 million.
So. Warwick Ross is one of the producers of a new documentary about the global wine economy and the way it is changing. It's called Red Obsession. Warwick, it's good to have you with us.
Thanks very much for having me.
Seems to me that wine is maybe the ultimate supply-demand thing, because once a 1945 Lafitte is bottled, man, there ain't no more.
There ain't no more. Limited supply. Yes, I think that's right. The really extraordinary vintages are held by collectors all over the world, and there are fewer and fewer of them as the years go on, of course, because people are drinking them.
And as people drink them and buy them, and as this movie talks about, trade them, inflation in the wine market is extreme.
Yes. The top-level wines of Bordeaux went up something like 1,000% in about 5-6 years, which is pretty extraordinary by anybody's markers. And in fact, wine has outperformed the stock markets, gold, FTSE, since something like 1982.
And so we get to the point of this film, which is, why is that happening?
Yeah, good question. I think it's a commodity. There's two things that are happening. One, you've got the people that are buying these wines to drink them, and that's what you'd expect to happen. But wine is also turning into a commodity. And once wine reached these extraordinary levels, and I mean something like $1,000 a bottle, and even higher than that, of course, they've become too valuable to drink.
That's a great phrase. Let's play that clip from the film. I love this. Too valuable to drink, too big to fail. We got it all.
In the past 10 years, prices of the top Bordeaux wines have risen by more than 1,000%. As the price of these wines continues to escalate, the inevitable has happened. They've become too valuable to drink.
Russell Crowe, of course, doing the voiceover there, which is cool. I love the ominous music.
Yeah.
What then is the average tippler to do if he wants just a little bit of red wine?
Well, I think you can find fabulous wines for $20 or $30, quite frankly. I don't think you need to spend $5,000 for a Lafitte Rothschild. But if you feel inclined and you've got the cash, then it's a pretty extraordinary experience.
The second half of this film sees you in Hong Kong with the Hong Kong wine auctions and also on the mainland in Shanghai and Beijing.
Yeah.
Talk to me for a second about the role of the Chinese in the global wine market, because that's kind of where this all comes down.
Yeah, well, 5 or 10 years ago, they didn't really exist in the global wine market. They've discovered wine in a major way, particularly in the last 5 years, and that's where some of these major collectors have really been making themselves felt, impacting the market in a huge way. So they collect the finest wines of Bordeaux. They see Bordeaux as the best wine in the world. It has the romance, it has the history, it has these glamorous chateaus. And Bordeaux itself has become a brand. And the Chinese, of course, are very brand-oriented, as everybody knows in the world. They want, you know, Nike, Louis Vuitton, Hermes, and now Bordeaux as well.
There's a great line from the film where you're talking to this Chinese wine expert, and he says, you know, we consume the wine. It's inside us now.
Yeah.
I mean, the Chinese are, you know, we want that luxury Western thing.
Yes, exactly right. But I rather like the fact that they see it in those terms, because in the West, wine, we're so used to it. And in China, the thing that really struck us is the level of respect that the Chinese collectors and drinkers have towards the vignerons, the winemakers, the people that are involved in the vineyard of these wines. There's great respect paid to these people. So when they, you know, pull the cork out of one of these incredible bottles, they treat it with with very, very high regard, and I think higher than a lot of the people in the West do.
Yeah, this is going to sound amazingly cynical, but the French wine companies, the Grand Cru wine companies, they know their market over there in China.
Yeah.
To the point where maybe it was Lafitte. You'll correct me if I'm wrong. One of them for the 2008 vintage, and the word eight in Chinese ba is propitious and brings fortune.
Yeah.
They put the Chinese character for eight right on that bottle.
That's right.
And boom, it sold like gangbusters.
Like gangbusters, yes. Was it a cynical exercise? Is it good marketing? I think that's the way you have to look at it. But fair enough, it was a very simple addition to the bottle. They knew that the number 8 meant all of those things, good fortune, prosperity, luck, everything else in China. The Beijing Olympics were a great example. It started at 8 p.m. Yeah. on the 8th of the 8th, 2008. And once Lafitte had put that symbol on the bottle, overnight in London, on the London Exchange, and there are exchanges for wine, the commodity of wine, in London, the prices went up by something like 40, 50% overnight.
Who's making the money?
Yeah, well, the Chateau owners would like to be making the money.
Yeah.
There are so many middlemen in the wine business. The Chateau sells to something called a courtier. The courtier sells to the négociant sells to the merchant, sells to you.
So, wow.
Yeah, there's a lot of markup in wine. But the Chateaus, I have to say, those top-level Chateaus that pushed the prices of the 2010 vintage to an all-time historic high of something like, $2,000 a bottle at retail, they are making a lot of money.
There is also this event that happens every year. And the French word escapes me. You'll help me here.
En primeur,
right. Where the critics come, they get an early taste of the wine, yeah, and then grade it, and then the Chateaus price accordingly.
Right, that's exactly right. The Chateaus and the critics, they have this sort of symbiotic relationship. They need each other.
Well, right. So we're going to play Jancis Robinson, who is a wine writer, the only wine writer that I know. And she sort of cuts right to the essence of it here. And you got her outside one of these Chateaus.
We are all pawns. We are all part of helping the Bordeaux Chateau owners get as much money as possible.
Right? I mean, she sort of lays it on the line.
Yeah, yeah. She calls a spade there.
Right, right. And yet people buy.
Yes, they do. Well, these wines are limited. You can't crank up production.
Yeah.
I think that's one of the fascinating things about wine. It's that limited production. It's the feeling that you may miss out, yeah, on something spectacular. So wine collectors will want to make sure that they have at least a few bottles of the most extraordinary vintage. And 2009, 2010 were being touted as the most spectacular vintages in maybe 50 or maybe even 100 years.
Have you had any of them, by the way, the 2010s?
Yeah, we were forced to drink these wines during the course of filming.
It's on that expense budget somewhere that the accountants are still trying to figure out.
Yeah, yeah.
Is it possible, as Russell Crowe says in the one of the voiceovers on this thing, these wines are too valuable to drink. Is there now a wine bubble?
Yeah, there certainly was a wine bubble. I think by the end of the 12 months of filming that period mm-hmm. we explored, the bubble burst. Now, things are coming back again because I think Bordeaux and probably the wine market has this sort of cyclical tendency, as almost anything does, I suppose, in a marketplace. But there was a huge bubble being created. The 2009 vintage was touted as the best vintage in 100 years. And then the very next year, the 2010 was being touted as the best vintage in 100 years.
In 101 years.
Robert Parker actually, he rated the 2009 wines, quite a few of the Chateaus, he rated them 100 out of 100, 100 points.
Yeah.
And then the next year came around and he again rated those wines around 100 points. So an interesting thing happened. The Chinese and what the Chateau owners did when he rated those wines again at 100 points, the Chateau owners took that as a sign that they could bump their prices, and they pushed them up by as much as 40% the very next year. So the Chinese sat back that year and said, hold on.
Huh.
If the 2009 is the same quality as the 2010, why do you think we would pay up to 40% more? We're just going to buy more of the wine you had last year.
Right. These wines, I was actually surprised to learn this watching this movie. Wines are, at some scale in the global wine trade, handled like commodities. If you buy 10 ounces of gold, you don't have to take the 10 ounces of gold physical possession. And it's the same way with wine. You can buy 25 crates of Lafitte and it just sits somewhere.
Exactly right. Yeah, there are brokers now set up in London who do nothing but buy and sell wine for their clients. And a client will phone and spend, £2-3 million with an order over the telephone. And 2 or 3 years' time, they'll sell the wine. These people never see the wine. In fact, one of the comments made by one of our interviewees was they don't even know what the bottle looks
right.
like.
which is bananas.
Yeah.
I mean, because isn't the whole essence of wine to have it and enjoy the sensuousness and all that?
Yes, that's right. And when you speak to the people in Bordeaux about this, it's this kind of love-hate relationship. I mean, they love to think that wine is making people money because ultimately it trickles down. It means they can charge more for their product if people are treating the wine as a commodity. But ostensibly, if you ask them the question, they hate the idea that the wines that they're making will never be tasted.
It always strikes me funny when I hear that the Chinese are interested in and buying in great quantities red wines. Because when I lived in China in 95, 96, and 97, Chinese domestic red wine was swill.
Yeah.
How is it now? Have you had them?
Yes, we have. Yeah. And it's getting better.
All right.
Yeah, they're really focusing on their wines in China. They're planting up to 20, 30,000 acres each year. And it's more or less state sponsored because, as you well know, most of the homegrown alcohols in China are so high in alcoholic content.
Baijiu, Maotai,
they blow your head off.
Right.
So the Chinese government realized some time ago that the best thing to do was to try and wean their population off these really high alcohol drinks and get them onto wine, onto grape-based wine, so because that's 13, 14%. So there's been a transition happening, and the people in China, even the young people now, have a real interest in wine. They go into the few wine shops that there are around places like Shanghai, Beijing. They will visit. They ask a lot of questions. If there are any tastings, they'll go. They educate themselves. They educate their palate. So wine has a gigantic future in China.
Is that future coming at the expense of the Western market? I mean, are Americans and Western Europeans now and Australians being priced out?
Yeah, well, we did have a comment. We've had a number of comments from people, but one was that, you know, in 20, 30 years' time, the entire world's production of wine will not be enough to satisfy the Chinese demand, which is an extraordinary comment. Being priced out, I mean, Australia and France, particularly Australia and France, are doing very well in terms of wine sales to China. France has a roughly 45% market share. Australia comes in second place with an 18% market share of wine. Now, both those markets are getting a little nervous that the Chinese are growing their own wines to this incredible degree. And the Chinese wines are actually beginning to win international trophies.
The Chinese, in fact, are so aggressive that they want to buy even when the chateaus don't want to sell. There was a guy who was trying to buy a case of, you know, $1,000 bottle of wines, and the chateau said, no, I'm sorry, we can't.
Yeah, that's right. Well, that's sort of library stock of wines going right back, I mean, going back to the 1800s.
Yeah.
And they know full well that if they agree to every request to sell these wines, whether it's $1 million for a few cases, those seller stocks could be cleared out pretty quickly. So they're very sort of abstemious with the way they drip feed these wines to the marketplace. Those are old and rare vintages.
But they will eventually run out. There will come a point where there is no more 1945 Lafite.
Right, exactly right. And that's why they can charge at the moment 25,000 euros. What is that, about 35?
Oh, I can't even do the math.
US dollars per bottle.
Yeah.
And the Chinese are wanting to buy these by the caseload. And at this particular chateau, they only had something like 7 or 8 cases of these left. And they've had these sitting there since 1945.
Yeah.
Yeah.
How'd you get Russell Crowe to narrate this thing? Is he a red wine guy? Is he a buddy of yours from the Outback or what?
Yeah, kind of. kind of both of those. He's definitely a red wine guy.
Is he?
He loves his red wine. And he's a close friend to Robert Coe, my executive producer on the film. So I had a short list of people that I wanted to narrate the film.
Yeah.
Maximus from Gladiator was on the top of the list.
Yeah.
I thought his voice in that film was
sounded great.
Spectacular.
He sounded great.
So I asked Rob, do you think you would mind phoning up Russell at some stage and seeing whether he'd be the least bit interested? So we actually had to cut some footage together, which we happily did, 3 or 4 minutes, like a promo, send it over there. He had a look at it and agreed to do it.
That's great. Warwick Ross, the film is called Red Obsession. He is the producer, co-director, and co-writer on this thing. Thanks much for coming in.
Pleasure. Thanks for having me.